Hey there, friends. A quick favor. We are conducting a brief audience survey. We'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes to provide your answers. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to complete it. That's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you.
Heads up, fans of the world. We're putting a little something extra in your feed. Things That Go Boom, a bonus podcast to loyal listeners of the world from PRX. Things That Go Boom. Let's roll.
Imagine living in a community where your community is eroding from the sea wave actions. How would you feel if your lives were in danger? Who would help you? Who would you turn to? Would you relocate? I'd rather not wait.
This is Things That Go Boom, your friendly neighborhood national security podcast. I'm Lacey Healy. This question, would you relocate? It's a question that could apply to millions of Americans before mid-century. As wildfires rage, floodwaters rise, and forecasters literally exhaust their list of names for hurricanes. As it gains steam, this migration could affect our economy, our social fabric, and even our foreign policy. And it's already happening. There's even a term for it, climigration. It's a word that originated in Alaska.
I'm Darlene Tuckett-Turner. I am a Inupiaq Eskimo. My great-great-grandparents were nomadic. I was born and raised here in Shishmaref, Alaska. Shishmaref is an island on the Bering Sea coast. Our population is nearly 700. We have one main street. A lot of people live in dry homes. You don't have a shower. You don't have flush toilets. We are subsistence people. We pretty much live off the sea. It's like our garden. It provides us bearded seals for our winter food. At the lagoon side, we fish our grayling fish, our whitefish, and blueberries, harvest berries, salmon berries.
Darlene says when she was a little girl, there was a half a mile of land between Shishmaref and the ocean. There was so much room on that spit of land that the mail carrier used to land his plane there once a week. There were baseball games on the beach, and the hunters would arrive there after they'd killed a bearded seal.
And the women would cut it open, lay the blubber down, you hang some of the meat to dry, trimmed into thin pieces, so that we can eat them like beef jerky. The families would get together and help. That's usually a very joyful time to see people. We'd enjoy the beach as our playground.
These days, that same beach is eroding. There's less sea ice to buffer the storms, and thawing permafrost weakens the shore. The waves have already washed away a dozen homes and half of the racks that people use to dry fish and seal.
When we have storms and from the wave actions that would slam into our permafrost to have our land, you know, collapse. Nowadays, we have warmer temperatures. For instance, right now, our ocean is open. It should have been frozen by now, as well as our lagoon.
If the water's not frozen, the townspeople can't travel to hunting and fishing grounds on their snowmobiles.
Earlier this summer, we experienced very high temperatures. The buds and the flowers of our salmon berries were burnt. If we miss the migration of our bearded seals due to lack of ice, then we would not have enough food to feed our families. About 2 or 3 years ago, the community of Shishmaref had voted to relocate to a different site, to a safer site.
And will you miss the place you're leaving?
Yes, I surely would. I would miss the ocean when it's nice and calm. The sound of the waves are really nice. It's cooler, and you can walk on the beach. And that's what I would miss.
Flooding and wildfires might not immediately come to mind when you think about national security. Usually that's the more obvious stuff that goes boom. But over the past three decades, the security community has come to see climate change more broadly that way. The first explicit recognition of the threat came in 1990, when a Naval War College report warned that naval operations in the coming half century could be drastically affected by the impact of global climate change. But concerns have only grown, as climate has become, according to the Pentagon in 2015, a present security threat, not strictly a long-term risk. It's a big topic, so we decided to bite off a smaller piece of it and focus solely on the risks from climate migration. Overseas, but also first, right here at home.
I'm Jesse Keenan. I'm an associate professor of real estate at the Tulane School of Architecture.
Jesse focuses on climate adaptation and the places where we live and work here in the U.S. He's the guy you call if you're not sure if you should build that third mansion on the Florida coast. But he's also convinced that we are on the cusp of a great northern migration that could make millions of us more vulnerable. He says people will flee flooding and wildfires on the coasts and deadly heat waves in the south.
Yeah, I think some portion of our country will participate in a great northern expanse. You know, the range of plants and animals in the northern hemisphere is moving slower and slower north. We measure this across dozens of species. They're slowly moving north. Well, guess what? People are going to do the same thing, right? Over time, we are going to slowly move further and further north until we become an extreme annoyance to our Canadian neighbors.
In a major report, ProPublica found that in the coming years, Buffalo, New York might come to feel more like Tempe, Arizona does today. And fresh water will become even more scarce. As a result of climate change, places like Miami, New York, and Boston will be profoundly altered. The report said, imagine dozens of new bridges connecting the islands of Philadelphia.
And I think that the scale, you know, when you think about other great American migrations like the Dust Bowl, you know, it's 4 to 5 times the size of the Dust Bowl, potentially. Oh. It could easily be 30 million people or more, you know, approximately 8% to 10% of the population may be in transit. And these are relatively conservative estimates.
To be fair, Keenan is talking about a shift over a longer period of time. But during the Dust Bowl migration, Oklahoma alone lost 440,000 people. The hardest hit ended up living in tents and shanty towns, working for survival wages. And the poverty trickled down for generations. These days, it's not so much droughts and dust storms that are the problem. Now, people are more likely to move because their house might be swamped from sea level rise.
Flooding emergency along coastal cities today in South Florida as rising tides are leading to flooded streets.
Most of Miami Beach could be underwater by the end of the century.
So that's a kind of pure physical, got to get out of the way kind of perspective. And, you know, that puts the numbers, you know, in the 6 to 7 million range right off the bat, just towards the end of the century. Once you start including extreme heat and extreme precipitation, in fact, extreme precipitation is a much more immediate sort of peril in many ways than sea level rise.
Flooding.
Yeah. We have these really big rainstorms, and when it rains, it pours.
Statistically speaking, the flood that happened in 2016 here was supposed to happen once every 1,000 years. Well, now it has happened twice in less than 2 years.
Our infrastructure and where we live is just not designed to handle this extreme precipitation. And by the way, that's happening today. It's part of our weather pattern today.
Of the top 10 years for extreme one-day precipitation events this century, 9 have occurred since 1990. So think about flooding in places like Houston or Nashville, where at the same time, temperatures are rising.
Even the labor economy is too hot to work outside, so we start losing labor productivity, labor output.
Jesse says there's a whole other group of people who might move because their insurance gets too expensive, or it gets too hot and humid for the kids to play soccer outside, or their county can no longer afford to repair washed out roads. Already, the impacts of climate change are beginning to play out in the housing market, leading previously high dollar beachfront property to lose value and driving up the cost to live inland. All this has led to inland gentrification, and as Jesse told us, it adds additional stress to an economy that's increasingly unequal, in a society that's increasingly unequal.
Certainly some historically marginalized communities and frontline communities, no doubt, are going to have a disproportionate impact. But I think when we look big picture, we recognize that no one is safe. and that anyone can become a climate grant in their lifetime.
So what are the risks to the country from climigration? Well, for one, our financial security could be eroded just as fast as our beaches. Jesse says there's already a climate change arms race underway, where asset managers and businesses and banks are vying for information that will help them predict how this all plays out. He won't name names, but he himself has had a phone call or two from an odd billionaire.
So that means, essentially, if I'm understanding what you're saying, right, that those who have the means will game this system.
It's already happening. You see this gaming going on. You see this in commodities. You see this in food markets. You see banks doing this with how they manage mortgages.
Jesse's been looking at small community banks in particular. They're right there in the community. So you'd assume they know pretty quick if they were holding mortgages on homes at risk from sea rise.
So we figured, well, with that superior information, they would probably manage their portfolio in sea level rise zones in a slightly different way, to the extent that they would shift the mortgages in sea level rise zones off their books and onto the federal government's books, or the GSEs, what we call Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which controls about half the U.S. mortgage market. So basically, they're shifting the risk from their books to Uncle Sam's books.
In other words, we could all be holding this debt. There's a lot of bad, but there are also a few silver linings. Some receiving communities could benefit from a brand new surge in economic activity and a milder climate. Places in the Rust Belt, for example, that have suffered a loss of industry and tourism could see a revitalization. And some others could become more attractive as well. Take Duluth, Minnesota, for example.
So yeah, it's cold. It's very cold there.
Duluth gets about 86 inches of snow a year. That's more than Anchorage, Alaska. They even have dog sledding races. But the University of Minnesota actually invited Jesse out to have a look at Duluth. Population 85,618. As a kind of model for the kind of northern city that might be revitalized by climigration. It's resource rich. There's lots and lots of water.
Being on Lake Superior.
It's sustainably minded.
No doubt, Duluth had a lot of things going for it.
But the city is having a hard time attracting new residents.
And I think that they had had, since the last census, a net positive population of 47 people.
In fact, Jesse even came up with an advertising campaign. They tried a couple of slogans, like
Duluth, not as cold as you think, or Duluth, the most climate-proof city in America.
Can you sell me on Duluth?
There's a lot of hipsters. There's an art scene. Oh, my God, the restaurants in Duluth.
What?
There's townhomes in Duluth that are identical in material and construction to what you would see in Brooklyn. And it's a good school system. You have a fraction of the price. Massive healthcare capacity. There's like these small batch distilleries. It's just stupid how cool Duluth is in so many ways.
Duluth is not recommended for people who are allergic to the cold. Side effects may include runny nose, frozen toes, and snow shoveler's elbow. Consult your physician if you have dreams about white sand and umbrella cocktails.
When we come back, we'll talk to an expert who's been watching for climigration. Not in Duluth, but overseas. And he thinks the Pentagon should be taking a closer look, too. When President-elect Joe Biden began naming members of his cabinet, one of the first was John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, who will become the first ever presidential envoy for climate. The choice put a fine point on just how high a priority climate change will be in the next administration, which is a bit of a turn from Trump's rhetoric on climate, but not necessarily from the guidance his administration produced. In 2019, the intelligence community's worldwide threat assessment called climate change an urgent and growing threat to our national security. There's even a think tank here in D.C. dedicated solely to examining the security risks posed by climate change.
I'm Francesco Femmia. I am the co-founder and a research director at the Center for Climate and Security. And so I came to the environment and sort of concern for the environment through music. There's a specific band, and this almost sounds made up. There is a band that I got into, which is an underground band in the Boston area called Earth Crisis. And of course, the name says it all. Yeah!
So you came to caring about the environment in a hot, sweaty, sticky, like underground basement watching a punk band.
Exactly right.
These days, Francesco spends a little less time in hot, sweaty basements and a little more time in briefing rooms. Though he did let us know he's still a big fan of punk. He's trying to figure out how prepared the military might be for what's to come, especially where climate migration is concerned, and especially in the world's hotspots. Although, sidebar here, he agrees with Jesse Keenan that this is also a big concern right here domestically.
I spoke with a former vice admiral of the Coast Guard, and I asked him, you know, if we were to get a Katrina Sandy-style storm.
Massive chunks of boardwalk littering the streets. Street after avenue after cul-de-sac.
One after the other.
And with much of New Orleans now underwater, authorities are focused on search and rescue.
And then, meanwhile, we have wildfires raging in the west.
Smoke mushroomed into thick blankets of clouds so vast they could be seen from space.
This was 3 years ago, I asked. Are we prepared to deal with that in a way that's acceptable to the American public? He said flatly, no, we're not prepared. And it was a little bit surprising. That has consequences for political stability in this country and potentially for security. And that's now.
Even in the U.S., it's not unreasonable to think that the impacts of climate change could lead to food and water shortages, devastate homes and land, and in some cases, cause mass migration. And all of these things can aggravate existing stressors.
Climate change is what we in our community call a threat multiplier, to say that climate change makes other security problems worse. It's really that simple. So if there's a place that doesn't get a lot of water already, then climate change might drive increased drought and a decrease in precipitation in those areas. And when people don't have a lot of water, that can lead to instability, displacement of peoples, and ultimately even conflict.
Syria, in some ways, is a good example of how climigration can become a stressor. Francesco says he became interested in Syria almost by accident. His team was studying a water project in Libya at the time, and this was 2012. So they were poring over precipitation maps from the previous 20 years.
And we noticed that Syria was bright red, and bright red means bad.
The red showed a dramatic precipitation decline.
And we started looking in further because at the time, the Syrian civil war was in its essentially its first year. And we thought, well, okay, that's interesting. And we noted that there was a major drought, actually considered the most extreme drought in its recorded history, that happened from 2007 until 2010.
Later research determined climate change had made the drought two or three times more likely. Coupled with natural resource mismanagement by the Assad regime, it decimated large swaths of farmland and sent as many as 2 million people to urban centers. When they arrived, many found that the city that they turned to for a new start didn't have the capacity to house, clothe, or care for them.
And there were other social and economic inequalities at play. There was favoritism from Assad towards certain ethnic groups over others. There were all kinds of reasons why people were upset.
Residents pour onto the streets to mourn 138 people killed overnight by government shelling.
Of course, you can't draw a direct line from climate change to the Syrian civil war. And you can't draw a direct line from climigration in Syria to climigration in the U.S. But Syria can teach us a lesson here about the future of conflict in the age of climate crisis. Sure, we will have water wars and direct battles over resources. But most conflicts don't sprout from a single source. They're a knotted collection of grievances, several pieces of kindling gathered together before they ever find a spark. When the military talks about the climate crisis as a threat multiplier, they're saying that it's going to stack a lot of kindling, enough to start a fire.
Climate change can contribute to displacing people. And when that happens in large numbers, in certain contexts, that can drive conflict, political instability. And then that can drive regional insecurity.
According to the UN, more than 400,000 people have been killed in Syria since the start of the war. And millions more have been displaced. At the same time, countries that have become hosts to Syrian as well as Afghan and Iraqi refugees have seen the reinvigoration of a hyper-nationalistic right wing.
So you get this isolationism, this sort of ethno-nationalism. That's a security problem.
Today, just 1% of the world is considered a hot zone, too hot to live. But if current trends continue, a new study has found that could rise to 19%, affecting a third of the global population. That's a lot of people who would have to move. Francesco says rejoining the Paris Agreement is a no-brainer, but he says we need to go way beyond that. If we don't act faster, he says, just think of this scene in Austin Powers.
It's a parody of a James Bond scene with a bunch of people in this warehouse shooting at each other. And there's a security guard who's facing off against Austin Powers. Austin Powers is driving a steamroller.
Hang on, I'm gonna floor it.
Austin Powers is yelling at the guy, move, get out of the way.
Move.
And for anybody who knows, steamrollers are just really slow. And instead of running out of the way, the security guard puts his hand out and just yells no for about 2 minutes. And then Austin Powers just slowly rolls over.
Right. And that's the thing. It's a slow roll. Maybe that makes it easier to ignore. We're going to leave you with one more story of climagration from right here at home. One that shows how changes that happen slowly, even over generations, still matter in a very big way.
My name is Jonathan Foray, and I am the executive director of the Wetlands Discovery Center. So I grew up in a town called Chauvin, which is in South Louisiana, the parish of Terrebonne, right on the Gulf Coast. To sort of give you an idea of what the Cajun culture is all about, I was able to buy my first television set because I worked on a trawl boat with my dad when I was like 7, 8 years old, you know? One of my favorite things to do as a pastime as a kid was play in the ditch. All of the houses have these long drainage ditches, and there were crawfish and snakes and little critters and things. And so, you know, my favorite birthday present I ever got as a kid was a minnow trap to be able to catch all the little critters, like a little biology lab.
Jonathan's mom's parents and his dad's parents and his aunts and uncles, they all lived on the same street.
You know, we have a crab boil, then everybody just went to that house. Yeah, the gumbos and the jambalayas and the boiled seafood. It was such a magical place to grow up in South Louisiana for sure. The first time that we had to move out of our home because it flooded, I guess I was probably around 9 or 10 years old.
This was Hurricane Juan in 1985.
As a child, it was pretty exciting because there's water in your house. Like, wow, check this out. Like, there are little minnows and things fishing. And of course, my parents were just devastated.
Jonathan's parents didn't have a lot of money, so they pulled out the carpet, shampooed it, and put the same carpet back down again. This was right before Halloween, and Jonathan remembers going trick-or-treating with an aunt while his parents were cleaning up the mess.
And I remember going door to door, and the ground was actually still mushy from the flood, you know, sort of like a wet sponge. My parents then drove around looking for the land that was the highest and not covered in water. And so that's where they decided to purchase property. So we moved from Chauvin to Berg.
They moved one town north and 4 feet higher above sea level.
I say it's different. It's a 5-minute drive. I think that was one of the most heartbreaking things is I didn't have a ditch at the new house. There was no ditch.
As it turns out, Jonathan's dad had also moved one town north years earlier, before Jonathan was even born.
My dad, through his lifetime, he has seen cow pastures turn from land that was able to be grazed upon to open water where people trawl and catch shrimp. You know, the land is changing very, very quickly here. And so what we experience here in southern Louisiana is called relative sea level rise. That means our land is sinking and the sea levels are rising. So we experience that at a faster rate than what other people across the coast would face.
Lots of people in the state are familiar with this. To buy some time, Louisiana's built a sophisticated levee system, but it's also channeled water into different flowing paths, which has brought its own set of problems. So these little moves north, mile by mile, away from the Gulf Coast, they're not uncommon.
We don't move far away from where we started because it's a really beautiful place. And then when it came time for me to buy a house, I actually moved one town north as well to Houma.
That's 10 feet above sea level.
I fell in love with the house that I bought because there are these oak trees on the property, and these oak trees are 150 to 200 years old. In my front yard, just on the other side of the road, is the bayou. So I have a son who is going to join us in March. I don't want it to be a Mad Max in the Thunderdome kind of world that I'm bringing my kid into. I do want them to thrive and be successful and be a part of what makes things better. One of the heartbreaking things that I have to think about is if my son will have to move north in the next few years. I mean, in my heart, I hope he moves one further town south. You know, I hope he finds a ditch that makes him happy.
Things That Go Boom is produced by Inkstick Media and distributed by PRX. This episode was produced by Ruth Morris, with a little help from me. It was edited by Marin Lazian, John Barth, and Layla Ujaili. Darian Shulman writes the music for our show, and Robin Wise takes each episode over the finish line. Thank you, as always, to the foundations that make our work possible. The Carnegie Corporation of New York and Plowshares Fund, as well as Inkstick supporters, including the Colomb Foundation, Craig Newmark Foundation, Prospect Hill Foundation, and the Jubitz Family Foundation. Thank you all for supporting our show, and Happy New Year. Here's to a better one. We'll see you right back here in 2 weeks. Given me an idea for my nephew, by the way, because they have a ditch and he would totally dig the minnow trap. I'm telling you right now.
And you can let him know he can bait it with bread. So if he takes a slice of bread from his mama or dad, then he can just put a little pieces of bread in it, and anything loves to eat the bread.
Oh, so he'll catch it. Perfect.
From PRX.